It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Today it's how a drink defined and then devastated an era. I'm talking about gin in England in the 18th century. As gin became the poor man's drug of choice, it also became an answer to the rich man's prayers. Our guest is Jessica Warner. Her book is Craze, Gin and Debauchery in an Age of Reason. Well, the Sterns are at a cafe in New Mexico where the maitre d' was a chicken. Gourmet magazine's John Willoughby has the skinny on that funky seasoning, Vietnamese fish sauce. Then baker Nancy Silverton takes on stale bread. Don't even think of tossing it. And finally, the story of a man, his machismo, and a stove. All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this.
Red ripe tomatoes. I'm never satisfied. I want the frim frim sauce with the aus and fade, with shafafa on the side. I don't want pork chops and bacon that won't awaken my appetite inside. I want the frim frim sauce with the aus and fade, with shafafa on the side. Well, you know a girl, she really got to eat, and a girl, she should eat right. 5 will get you 10. I'm gonna feed myself right tonight. I don't want fish cakes and rye bread. You heard what I said, waiter, please. I want my fried, I want the frim frim sauce with the Austin Fay, with Chef Bonfa all on the side. Shoot, do, 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 yeah, do, do. Shoot, my do, ya do, say you didn't do. Inside, I want the frim frim sauce
with the Os and Faye, with Shafafa on the side. Now you know, girls, we really got to eat, and you know we should eat right. Fire will get you ten. I'm gonna feed myself right tonight. I don't want fish cakes and rye bread. You heard what I said. Waiter, please, I want my mind fried. I want the frim fram sauce with the os and fay, with Chef Baba on the side.
Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and brought to you by Super Target. Well, today it's how a drink helped devastate a people. I'm talking gin's 30-year reign in the London of the 18th century, but it could be today. You've got the rich getting richer from the poor's addiction to gin, then the rich blame the problem on the weak morals of the poor, and there's more. Much more. Our guest is Jessica Warner. Her book is Craze, Gin and Debauchery in an Age of Reason. Well, John Willoughby gets us past the funk of fish sauce. Master bread baker Nancy Silverton talks great dishes from stale loaves. We've got the saga of a man and his stove from food writer David Leet. And then it's sleep eating. That's right, eating while you're sound asleep. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. So let's get rolling with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet magazine. So, Jane, Michael, I understand you guys were in New Mexico.
We were, Lynn, and we confirmed there one of our suspicions about finding great food along the road. And that suspicion is if you find a place with a lot of live poultry running around and cackling outside, you've probably found a good restaurant to eat if they serve food there. And sure enough, the San Marcos Cafe on the Turquoise Highway down towards Cerritos, New Mexico. We approached the place, and there outside were peacocks, peahens, chickens, roosters, wild turkeys, all cavorting about. You have to kind of walk through them to get into the place. Once we got in, proprietor Susan McDonnell told us about what was probably the best-known chicken who ever lived there. Tell us about Buddy.
He was our favorite. He was a chicken, as his obituary says, that was a school project. So he went home all by himself with no other chickens around to this little girl's house, and she raised him, so he thought he was a human. And when I got him, I put him in a chicken pen, and he absolutely, you could see right away, the look on his face, he said, I don't belong here. So we brought him, and we kept him on the porch, and he lived with us, and he was just everybody's pet, and he loved to chase little kids. His ears just perked up if he had ears. When he'd see a little kid get out of the car, and he was so disappointed if they weren't afraid of him.
I've heard that he was the official or unofficial maitre d' of the cafe.
He was our maitre d'. He had his own little bow tie, and he'd greet people, chase them if he could.
If you tell me that they serve chicken, I think I'm going to cry.
We had some delicious eggs there, I must say.
They have the best eggs. Now, Buddy, as Susan McDonnell told us, I mean, passed away. I mean, you know, this is a chicken with an obituary.
However, he is also a chicken who is remembered by the refrigerator magnets they sell with Buddy's picture on them.
Where he's wearing his little bib and tucker, and sort of has one claw in the air, sort of like welcoming people into the San Marcos Cafe. But the fact is, even if you're not a rooster lover, which I am a major rooster lover, you get to this place and there are peacocks and peahens, wild turkeys, roosters, chickens, you know, all sorts of poultry just running around. Some are in pens, some are loose. they're not inside the restaurant, but as Michael said, they have fabulous breakfasts, great omelets, some of the best cinnamon rolls that we've ever tasted. And they have a fluffy scrambled egg wrapped in a tortilla sided by beans, chili, guacamole, and melted cheese. And I mean, after you eat this enormous breakfast, you feel like you would want to sit on a nest and roost for a while.
Hatch some eggs.
You know, I think Michael and I have started a short list of restaurants with roosters. There's one in Key West, Florida called Blue Heaven, which also is pretty much a breakfast place. And you sit out on a patio and chickens and roosters run wild around you as you're eating. And there definitely is some sort of correlation between great breakfasts and free-ranging chickens in your face and under your feet. So I think maybe our next guidebook will be rooster food.
Eat where the chickens eat.
Eat where the chickens eat.
Does San Marco Cafe do lunch, and do they do other meals other than breakfast?
They do breakfast and lunch only. And the amazing thing about it is, way out on Highway 14 as it is, it's so popular that if you want to go there for lunch on a weekend, you actually have to call and make a reservation. I mean, we're not talking about a fancy place here. We're talking about a roadside cafe that's also a feed store.
In the middle of nowhere on the Turquoise Trail.
It's really popular because the breakfasts are delicious, and I don't think we've really done justice to that cinnamon roll there. I mean, you know, Jane and I kind of make a sideline of sampling cinnamon rolls wherever we go, and this is truly one of the best, because too often cinnamon rolls are kind of thick, doughy, and heavy. This is air light. It's almost like a croissant, except it's very tall, kind of crisp and crunchy and buttery and sweet. It's one of the best cinnamon rolls I've found anywhere.
They also, and I mean, Buddy would put his fingers to his ears if he had fingers and ears, but they do have a fabulous smoked chicken sausage for lunch also, which comes with pico de gallo, which means
Nip of the rooster.
Nip of the rooster.
How appropriate.
Yes, that does make me nervous. Thank you, guys.
Bye, Lynn.
Goodbye.
Orange feet in soil, scratching and pecking for grit. Chickens in the sun.
Haiku by Brave Combo. Jane and Michael Stern's latest book in their road food series is Louie's Backyard Cookbook. Now, you know they visit us each week, but you can get their food finds anytime. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. Now, if you think, after all of that business about chicken, I'm going to let you get away without foisting a recipe on you, well, no way. I have found the perfect scrambled eggs. Sheila Connolly, the chef at Mildred Pierce Cafe in St. Paul, did these scrambled eggs with cream cheese and fresh herbs. They were bliss on a fork. Now, the cream cheese barely melts. The eggs are scrambled slow, so they turn firm, yet moist and creamy. In short, I've worked up the recipe for our weeknight kitchen newsletter, and I did that a while ago, but I have to use it again. We dubbed it Luxury Scrambled Eggs. Now, you can get the recipe and the weekly newsletter on the website, splendidtable.org. John Willoughby is one of those masters of a craft. The cookbooks he writes with his pal, Chef Chris Slazenger, win awards. He's written for just about every major food publication. He's now executive editor of Gourmet Magazine, and we're lucky enough to have him drop by regularly here at the Splendid Table. Hey, John, welcome back.
Great to be here, Lynn.
What have you been doing lately? What have you been working on?
Well, I just got back from Vietnam. And while I was there, I went to this island called Phu Quoc, where they make the world's best fish sauce. So I'm really into fish sauce right now.
Well, you know, okay, so they make it there. Could you explain what it is? Because I think a lot of people aren't familiar with it.
I will, but before I explain it, I have to say one thing, which is that it sounds gross, but it is not. All right, so I'm going to tell you how they make it, and it sounds kind of gross, but it's really a wonderful product, so keep that in mind. What they do is they take small fish, the best kind is small anchovies, and they dry them slightly and then pack them in salt, and they put them in these huge wooden vats. When I walked into this place in Fuquoc, they had like 40 of these huge wooden vats, the size of the vats that they ferment wine in, and they let them sit there for 3 to 6 months and ferment. And as they ferment, liquid from the fish comes out, trickles out of the bottom of these vats, and they collect it. And then when they have another big vat of it, they let that sit for a month to sort of mellow and ferment a little further. And that's fish sauce. And the best fish sauce is nothing but that. It's just fish and salt. That's it.
And that must smell just heavenly.
Well, you should never smell fish sauce. Do not smell it, because then you'll never use it, because it has a very unpleasant smell. It smells kind of like old socks. But the smell is 1,000 times more intense than the flavor. In fact, if you use fish sauce correctly, you will barely taste it. But if you make the same dish with fish sauce and then without fish sauce, the one with fish sauce will have a much rounder, fuller, deeper flavor. It functions really, a lot of people say, oh, it's fish sauce is to Southeast Asian cuisines what soy sauce is to Chinese. But I think that's not right. Soy sauce is, you distinctly taste it in Chinese cooking. It's more like, fish sauce is more like salt in Western cooking. You don't really taste it if you're using it right, but it amplifies the flavors and the deepness of the dish, and you would miss it if it wasn't there. So when you use fish sauce, you should use it rather sparingly, certainly until you get used to it, and then you'll start getting used to it, and you'll be missing it if you're not using it in Southeast Asian-style dishes or even in your regular cooking.
Fish sauce, give me some.
Well, I use it in, I mean, basically with Southeast Asian flavors, and you're not using fish sauce, you're missing the sort of flavor palette of Southeast Asia. But I've also started using it in other ways. I put like a couple of teaspoons in the braising liquid from braised pork, for example.
Mm-hmm.
No one knows it's in there, but they think it's great. The other night I made now this is going to sound a little weird, but it was really great. I made a vinaigrette for a salad, and I just put a teaspoon of fish sauce in it. And no one knew what it was, but everybody really loved the vinaigrette. They thought it was really rich and delicious. So it really is very versatile, and I think what you should do is start out making some Southeast Asian dishes just to get used to how to use it, and then start using it where you might use soy sauce, or even in some things where you might use salt. Just use a little bit of fish sauce, and I think you'll really come to love it. Just don't smell it.
You know, everything you're describing reminds me of how you can use anchovies, that a very tiny bit of anchovy, which you really don't taste, can enrich so many different things. But do you have a brand that you particularly like? I mean, you've been to the source now, so you must have
some
brands.
Well, actually, if you talk to the experts in Asia, they all recommend Fuquoc brand, which is the island that I went to. It's for 2 centuries been known as the place where they have the best fish sauce because of the particular type of anchovies that they use. So I would recommend Fuquoc. If you can't find Fuquoc, there's a Thai brand called Squid Brand, which is pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
But better than a particular brand, the best thing to do is make sure you buy fish sauce in glass containers instead of plastic, because it's always a higher grade. And you can look on the label, and it will say NHI somewhere on the label, which basically means it's a very high protein content, and that's the best fish sauce. So just look for one that says NHI on the label.
NHI. All right, can you spell Fuquoc for us, please?
I can. In Vietnamese, it's pronounced Fuoc. But all of us Westerners call it Fuquoc. It's P-H-U, new word, Q-U-O-C.
Okay, Fuquoc, N-H-I. Look on the label and we'll know we'll get good fish sauce.
Absolutely.
And never smell it. Thank you, John.
Thank you, Lynn.
John Willoughby is executive editor of Gourmet Magazine and co-author with Chris Lasinger of Let the Flames Begin. Now, he's left us with a recipe for spicy cabbage salad with chili rubbed flank steak. And yes, it does call for fish sauce. You can find it on the website, splendidtable.org. Coming up, debauchery and gin, in praise of stale bread, and open lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed by PRI. Thank you. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target, a grocery store and Target store all in one. In addition to a complete Target store, Super Target features a bakery, deli, fresh produce, meats, and seafood. To find the Super Target nearest you, you can visit them online at Target.com. Human history has seen three constant and potent bedfellows. I'm talking the big three: morality, politics, and addictive substances, like alcohol. And like most triumvirates, their relationship has been all about betrayals and power plays. This trio at work is the story told in a new book. The book is Craze: Gin and Debauchery in an Age of Reason. Its author is history professor and research scientist in addiction, Jessica Warner. Jessica, welcome to the show.
Thank you so very much.
Okay, now this is really a titillating title, Jessica. You have Debauchery in the Age of Reason. Well, what kind of debauchery and what age are we talking about?
Well, the debauchery consists of a massive upsurge in drinking, of the drinking of gin, and that occurred in the early 18th century up until about 1751. And the Age of Reason, stolen from Tom Paine, is the 18th century, the age that we associate with beautiful classical architecture and civil manners.
And where are we talking about?
We're definitely talking about London, which was the largest city in Europe at the time. And London is very much like American centers. It's large, sprawling, complex. You have major pockets of poverty and major pockets of wealth, and the two cultures clash. Gin is very much inconsistent with the orderly architecture, say, of West London and of Kensington.
Why gin? I mean, they had cider, they had beer, which had been around for a long time. What was the deal with gin?
Well, there were several factors. One simply was that the population had stopped growing, and there was also a surplus of grain. This left landowners with something of a dilemma. How would they get rid of this extra grain? They couldn't make more bread. So one solution was simply to distill it, and that's one impetus behind it. There's also a cultural impetus behind it. The 18th century has been dubbed the consumer age, and people were becoming very interested in experimenting with new substances. Tea and coffee come most immediately to mind, as does chocolate. So this wish to experiment also percolated down to the lower classes. So they started drinking gin, which became sort of the ersatz punch, the comparison being to the brandies and rums that the upper classes drank.
So this was poor man's, essentially.
Spirits. Absolutely. Yes, and I should add that this is not gin as we know it. It's simply terrible, terrible hooch. It's basically a form of moonshine. Sometimes they add juniper berries, sometimes they don't. But the usual strategy is to add sugar or fruit to mask its horrible taste.
So what turned this into a craze? I mean, how did the craze express itself?
Well, it expressed itself by a sharp increase in consumption, primarily in London, but to a lesser extent in other urban centers. Really, what it is a beer and gin craze. They drink vast quantities of gin, but they continue to drink just as much beer as they had before. So these two alcoholic beverages in combination create an era of drunkenness in the slums of East London and Westminster.
Can you paint a picture for us? What was it like? What was infuriating the upper class so much?
Well, there are lots of people who simply drop dead in the streets. There are also drunks who are sprawled out in the streets, which sort of evokes modern urban America to a certain extent. But I think the primary objection was more aesthetic, that people's behavior was unbecoming, that drunks standing in the way of coaches in the street was displeasing to the upper classes. It's a picture of squalor. It's also a fairly simple equation. Gin is the source of every bad thing you see in Gin Lane. Take away gin and in comes the jolly prosperity of Beer Street, which is the counterpart to Gin Lane.
Well, what you describe in the book is gin being sold everywhere by everyone.
Absolutely. It's the Mary Kay industry of 18th century London.
Oh, my Lord.
You have people selling it out of their houses. The gin shops really are nothing more than the back rooms in ordinary people's houses. You have women selling it on the streets. You have people selling it from the barges that go up and down the Thames. You have people selling it in prison, outside prison, at hangings. So wherever poor people congregated, gin was sold.
So what eventually happened? How was this resolved?
Well, it really ran a fairly leisurely trajectory, much like other drug scares that we've encountered. It basically ceased to be interesting to people. It lasted for about a generation, which seems to be the trajectory of other drugs that are introduced into the market. Another factor, too, is that in the second half of the 18th century, real wages started to decline just as the population started to increase. So the poor people ceased to have the disposable income to spend on gin. That certainly was one inhibiting factor.
So, Jessica, what lessons can we take from all of this into today?
Well, I think one of the lessons is to take a somewhat more complex and at the same time more relaxed attitude toward drugs. Inevitably, new drugs are going to hit the market. Not to associate the drugs with the social problems that actually cause people to be interested in drugs. That definitely is one of the major lessons. And I'm afraid that one of the lessons is somewhat nihilistic. We found in more statistical studies, the ones that preceded the book, that there's very little that the state can do to control drugs. So what it can do, and this is the more expensive solution, is to control or ameliorate the circumstances that make drugs attractive in the first place.
Well, when you said a more relaxed attitude toward drugs, are you saying they should not be regulated? Because drugs get pretty deadly these days.
Actually, I'm not going to make a statement one way or the other on that. I'm merely claiming that there's very little that can be done. State intervention does not seem to work. It certainly did not work in the case of the gin scare. In many ways, it aggravated the gin scare by making it a rallying cry for the lower classes. Gin became their way of defying the government. It drew undue attention to gin. Mm-hmm. It's fairly comparable to the way Just Say No campaigns often glamorize drugs and make people think more about drugs than they need to.
Hmm. A lot to think about. Jessica, thank you.
Thank you so very much.
Jessica Warner is author of Craze, Gin and Debauchery in an Age of Reason. She is professor of history at the University of Toronto and research scientist at the Center for Addiction and Mental Health. Last week, you spent nearly $5 on a loaf of bread. You polished off half of it, and now you have an expensive doorstop. It's stale, and you're going to toss it. Don't. Bread, stale or fresh, is precious stuff in most of the world, and there are wonderful ways of using it. Now, the person to talk to about this is master bread baker Nancy Silverton. She has La Campanile Bakery in Los Angeles, and she bakes thousands of loaves of bread every day. Her latest book is Nancy Silverton's Sandwich Book. Hey, Nancy, welcome.
Thank you.
Now, Nancy, I figured we'd come to you to learn about what to do with stale bread, but it suddenly occurred to me, do you ever have any stale bread?
I do have stale bread, actually, all the time at my house.
Well, okay, before we go to stale bread, what is the best way for us to keep that loaf of bread?
Well, it really depends upon the size of the loaf of bread, meaning a large loaf, 1 to 2 pounds. Breads such as those and breads made in the method that we make using a sourdough starter, which is almost a little bit of a preservative, meaning breads keep longer mm-hmm. when they're made that way. They really are meant to be kept at room temperature for 2 to 3 days, and they will definitely last. The smaller loaves, such as the rolls or the skinny baguettes, they really only have a one-day life. So with those, the best way to keep them is to eat what you're going to eat and then freeze it immediately.
And never put them in the refrigerator.
Never put in the refrigerator. That is the worst environment for bread. It stales and dries out the quickest.
Huh. And do you put them in plastic bags?
In the freezer, I do. When I have a large loaf, I just leave it out of plastic on the countertop.
Okay. And the cut side down?
Cut side down once you cut it right, because that keeps it fresher, right? It stops it from drying out.
Right. Okay, so after 2 or 3 days, it's really on its way to becoming a doorstop. So let's get down to the nitty-gritty about what can we make with this bread as it's starting to dry out. What are the things you like to do?
Well, first of all, I love to simply toast it, rub it with a clove of fresh peeled garlic.
Mm-hmm.
And with that, you have the most wonderful garlic bread. Or take the slice after you toast it, rub it with the garlic, cut it up into smaller pieces, and make what the Italians call crostini toppings.
Uh-huh. What about bread salads?
Bread salads are a terrific way to use up bread that's not as fresh as you would like. And I simply cut the loaf of bread in half, and I like to pull out really large chunks of the bread rather than cutting it up into small cubes. I like the rustic look, and I like the irregular sizes. And I pull out the chunks, toss it in a little extra virgin olive oil, and toast it in the oven at about 325 degrees until it just becomes crisp and just starts to color. And then whatever, you know, whatever season it is what kind of bread salad I make. And I make them most often actually in the summertime. And I spend my summers in Italy, so jealous.
Yeah, okay.
And the bread salad that I make in the summertime is usually with roasted red pepper, capers, anchovy, and tomato. And it's the natural juices of the tomato and the juices that the peppers give off that also further moisten the bread. And I help it along with a little vinaigrette.
The trick of roasting it in the oven, that I've never heard of that before, and that's a wonderful trick. Okay.
I also, you know, in the wintertime, I have to tell you what I love to do with it, because I was just thinking, it was on our menu at Campanile, and in my sandwich book, I have a chapter on sort of sandwiches, and they're sort of sandwiches because there's so much bread involved, it's almost like a ripped-up sandwich. But
right. The
one that I do is a sort of a take on the frisé lardon.
You mean, when you say frisé, you mean those tart greens that look like someone's hair has been frizzled?
Yeah, like my hair. But it's a classic French bistro salad that's usually made with these sturdy frisé, a poached egg, bacon, and a mustard vinaigrette. And I love that salad. But I do it with the torn pieces of bread with huge chunks of bacon, hard-cooked egg that's sort of just broken up into huge chunks, and a mustard vinaigrette, and it's a great, great salad.
The mouth is watering. What's your take on the idea of revitalizing sort of stale bread by sprinkling it with water, wrapping it, and putting it in the oven? Is that kind of okay?
It does work. I mean, you don't want to add too much water to make it too soggy, right? Because I think you'd have to cook it too much. But I have suggested to people to actually spray the outside of the loaf of bread, because, you know, the bread stales from the outside, right?
Right.
So spray it a little and then pop it in the oven. And actually, if you're going to freeze it, and I'm not a person that heats my bread, by the way, but if you're going to freeze your bread, I always recommend to let it thaw out at room temperature and then pop it back into a hot oven for a few minutes to crisp up the crust.
Okay.
You know, Lynn, another great way to use stale bread is to make them into breadcrumbs. One of my favorite pastas is just a simple garlic, olive oil, and tons of ground breadcrumb pasta.
Sounds great, Nancy. Hey, thank you.
You're welcome.
Nancy Silverton is author of Nancy Silverton's Sandwich Book. Now, she left us with her recipe for that salad. It's called Sort of Frisé Lardon. And you can get it on the website, splendidtable.org. You know that feeling you want something so bad because you know it will change your life? I mean, how else would all those balloon-wheeled pickup trucks end up on city streets? So far from the farm. Well, food writer David Leet knows this kind of lust deep in his soul. And he knows how it can transform us.
I've never been in love before. Now all it's you. It
It got to the point where I couldn't walk into a bar anymore. You know the kind, the true bastions of testosterone. The ones so thick with blue smoke, the neon beer signs looked like UFOs hovering in a patch of midnight fog. It wasn't for moral or religious reasons, lack of money, or even an alcohol problem that prompted me to slink out, emasculated, never to return. It was because I was a phony. While other guys swapped J-Lo fantasies or nearly came to blows defending their classic El Caminos, all I could think about was a commercial-style Viking stove and white enamel. I stared into the mirror, tawny with nicotine, and dreamed about how perfectly risen my white chocolate cloud cake would be, thanks to my baffled heat convection oven. The slow disenfranchisement of my manhood, as one friend likes to call it, began 8 years ago when I took my first cooking class. I walked into the kitchen, and there, lined up against the wall, were three hulking 48-inch Vikings, gleaming like a row of squat sumo wrestlers. I was smitten. Their unqualified size and power thrilled me. Was this what my father felt when he walked with mouth agape through the lawnmower department at Sears? My enthusiasm, though, lasted until I got home. The most my postage stamp-sized kitchen could handle was a mini-me version of the Colossi from class. Not to be outmaneuvered by Manhattan real estate, I opted instead for the still manly 30-inch model for my weekend home in Connecticut. That big boy was big enough to come with bragging rights and delicate enough to turn out flawless tweels. Of course, buying this monster would require some creative accounting because, thanks to a suicidal economy, the money I had set aside for a rainy day had long ago evaporated. Cashing in my paltry IRA was clearly out of the question, so I looked around for something to sell. My eye landed on my 1987 Mercedes, which I had christened Sadie. My heart sank. That old car had taken me everywhere, and I adored her. I stood in the kitchen looking at the catalog, chock-a-block with shiny new Vikings, and then at Sadie. Vikings, Sadie. Vikings, Sadie. After some haggling, I got just enough for the Mercedes dealership to buy the stove. Once alone with my coveted Viking, which I immediately nicknamed Thor, I whipped out a batch of cookie dough I had made earlier that morning. I fired up the oven and scooped out 9 identical balls of the stuff. I slid them into the inferno and waited precisely 10 minutes. When I opened the door, I realized I had a steep learning curve ahead of me. My cookies had been, for lack of a better descriptive, incinerated. I was undeterred. It was simply a matter of learning the Ranger's distinctive personality, I told myself. Well, it took ruining a cobbler, 2 chickens, a lemon tart, and a dozen more cookies before I was able to harness Thor's might. But after that, I could roast any fowl my butcher threw my way, sauté the crunchiest sweetbreads, and turn out an almond financier with a crumb so fine, even Julia Child would be jealous. Last night, I crept downstairs to look at Thor, not unlike how those men in car commercials tiptoe up to the garage and curl up to sleep inside their new BMWs. I ran my fingers along the sleek, sexy door handle. I revved up each burner to its full 15,000 BTUs. I thought of the guys at the Marbledale pub and their raucous one-upmanship. I imagined marching back in there with my towering white chocolate cake, the Gila version with the pistachio buttercream frosting. I place it on the bar amid the overflowing ashtrays and empty beer cans, and watch. Conversation about Heidi Klum sputters to a halt, and the brutes begin to circle. Without waiting for forks, one digs in, then another, and another, caveman-like. And as they give themselves over to the pleasures of French butter and imported white chocolate, the machismo vanishes. And when the plate is empty, they rush me, offering the keys to their Dodge Ram pickups and to their girlfriend's apartment in exchange for one more impossibly perfect bite of cake. I toss back my head and laugh. I turn and saunter out the door, leaving them despondent. I win. I am victorious.
David Leib is a freelance food writer living in New York City. He and Thor are testing recipes for David's forthcoming book on Portugal. Well, it's time for our weekly trivia challenge. Where does the expression to eat humble pie come from? Now, we're going to have that answer in a moment, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed by Public Radio International. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is supported by SuperTarget, offering ingredients for your favorite recipes, from real semolina brass-cut Italian pastas to a wide variety of European cheeses. You can visit them online at Target.com to find a store near you. Now, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls in a moment. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. The question was, what's the origin of the expression to eat humble pie? Well, you know it means to submit to humiliation, but the real story here is about a little-known fact of master-servant relations in the 17th century. My trusty Oxford English Dictionary says that back then, when the huntsman, who was the subject of a nobleman, brought down a deer for his master, his reward was the numbles of the deer, meaning the innards that no one else would eat. And since in those days almost everything was baked in a crust, along with enough strong seasonings to cover any nasty flavors, they went into what was called numble or humble pie, the food of inferiors. The lines are officially open, and you can reach us at 800-537-5252. Okay, let's get right to the phones. We've got Sarah on the line. Hi, Sarah. What do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. Thanks for having me. I am the chef of a French bistro. I just started about a week ago, and I've created a menu, but I thought I'd see if you had any thoughts, and in your travels, if you've seen any great French bistro items that might help me out a little bit.
Well, congratulations, first of all.
Thank you.
Is this the first foray you've had with this kind of food?
It is.
Okay. I guess when you say bistro, I mean, I go back to the real classics. I mean, the kind of food that you could have eaten in France 30 years ago and you can still eat today in, you know, the great local restaurants, the true bistros.
Yes.
And usually those are not terribly upscale. And it's this kind of good, honest French food. I mean, I'm thinking about things like incredible fried potatoes, you know, absolutely brilliantly done. They're roast chicken with things like butter and lemon and tarragon under the skin.
Mm-hmm.
And just roasted beautifully crisp and served to a, you know, maybe four people at the table in just an oval metal dish, you know, and it's still sizzling from the oven, that kind of thing. Potato gratin, where you've got, in fact, we've got a recipe on the website. I think it's just called gratin of potatoes with garlic and cream. And it's from southern France. And all it is slices of potato, chunks of garlic, and a ton of cream. and it's just baked and baked until everything melts together, and there is just a fabulous crust of cheese on the top that you put the last moment. And then the thing that keeps coming back, I mean, this is the crusty, small goat cheese that you've grilled or you've pan fried in olive oil, so it's crusty on the outside and starting to go molten on the inside.
Mm-hmm.
And you plop that on a salad that you've just dressed with oil and vinegar and maybe garlic. And the salad usually has curly endive or frisée in it, so you want something prickly and tart. And that combination, my mouth is watering. That combination could bring you to your knees. But this is old hat. I mean, does this sound boring to you?
Well, I think I'm sort of along those lines. Do you have any ideas for seafood?
Oh, well, seafood. I mean, one of the great, the true classics, and this, again, is one of those things that will never die, and it's always exciting, is to grill fish over dried fennel. And you can and this is, again, going back to the south of France, where you actually, you might be doing it over a grill in the kitchen, but you have dried fennel twigs or sprigs, which you can mail order, you can get, I think William Sonoma carries them, you know, you can find them. And the idea is that as the fish is finishing, you've stuffed the inside of the fish with lemon and fennel and garlic to begin with. This is usually a whole fish that's done, maybe a bass or something like that. And as you're turning the fish the last couple of times, you would throw this dried fennel onto the fire and let it flame up, let it crisp the fish with that wonderful scent. And then again, the whole fish comes to the table and it's filleted at the table.
Oh, that's a great idea.
And you sprinkle it with the fronds of the fresh fennel, you know,
okay.
And then, yeah, I mean, it's really, it can be sensational and looks absolutely breathtaking. I mean, one of the other classics in this, I've served this so many times, I've lost track, a local fresh goat cheese, whatever you've got locally. Drizzle it with lavender honey.
Oh.
Yeah, and it's wonderful. And serve that with whatever fruit is in season. Like right now, it might be grapes. Later on, it might be strawberries. And you just put that out. It's sort of a combination cheese course with the beginning of a light dessert.
Oh, that sounds really nice.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
You are welcome. Thank you for letting me just rattle on.
Well, if you're ever in Salt Lake, stop by Oh Bon Appetit.
You're on. You're
great.
On. Next time I come to Salt Lake, I love Salt Lake. Hey, thank you for a great question.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Talk about a trip down memory lane. Well, call us, 800-537-5252. We have Freya on the line. Freya, how are you? What do you want to talk about?
I'm good, thanks. I am catering my son's bar mitzvah luncheon this June for 200 people.
You nice mom, you.
Well, you know, this is such an event that I really feel like I need to be personally doing this as opposed to just shoveling it off to someone else. And I have wonderful resources here. I live in Boulder, Colorado, and I'm a vice president of Wild Oats Markets, which is a natural and organic national food chain.
About being on the inside track. Yes, okay.
Absolutely. And I put some of my guys on thinking about this, but we haven't been able to come up with something really good. I need one or two good desserts that could be made in quantity that are nice, light fruit flavors that can go out in June in Colorado, which could be, it could be 100 degrees.
I know.
And hang there without refrigeration for an hour or more without killing anyone.
Okay, so we want fresh, we want fruity, light, and fresh.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And hopefully something that could be prepared at least a few days in advance, if not well in advance and frozen.
I can't resist. I've got to go back to my Italian heritage. Is alcohol a problem? Wine.
It shouldn't be.
Okay, because this is what I'm thinking. I have called this dish so many things I cannot tell you. Most recently, iced peaches, ice chilled peaches. Now, it can be done with berries or whatever, but it's really wonderful. You get those Western slope peaches, but I think they come in later than June. But you could do this. You could do this with strawberries. You could do this with cherries. It would be wonderful. It is, you take a sparkling wine that has some sweetness to it, a little bit like a Prosecco or a very good Asti Spumante. You take the fruit, you put it in a bowl, a non-reactive container. You sprinkle the wine in. You sprinkle it generously with sugar. Okay. And then I'd rip some Thai basil leaves in between the layers, and you put it in the refrigerator overnight. And everything macerates. Now, with stone fruits like peaches and nectarines, they become soft, but they absorb all of this fabulous flavor. And the alcohol in the wine opens up flavors that nothing else does. Flavors are soluble in alcohol that are not soluble in any other substances. And then you serve this chilled. Now, you can drain off the wine or leave it as is. But then you put fresh basil leaves over the top, and perhaps you have on the side, you have something like good local sour cream from a local dairy that's been flavored with honey and more of that basil. It's a lovely dessert. You could layer things that way as well if you chose, but it's that saturation process. Another one, again, a dish that I've fallen back on for a long time. Strawberries are in great shape in June, and raspberries are starting to come in. You puree the raspberries, sugar, a little vanilla. You have gorgeous strawberries, leave some of them whole. You blend the two together early in the day. You put it in a beautiful glass compote, and that, again, with whipped cream on the side or something creamy on the side, is unbelievable. It's strawberries and raspberry sauce, an old, old French trick that is just delicious, and it's the longer it stands within reason, that wants about a couple of hours, the better it gets. But none of these things are going to spoil in heat. Uh-huh. Is this taking you down the path you're thinking of?
That's great.
Okay, so see how that works for you.
I appreciate it very much.
And you are a great mom.
Well, you know, I love my son.
Congratulations to your son and to your family.
Thank you.
Take care, Freya.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye. You know that old bit when you see your weight jump up, you say, I just don't know how it happened? Well, part of that could be true. You may be one of the 4 million Americans who could be suffering from a curious malady that's called NSRED. Well, we have Lee Montgomery on the phone. She is an instructor of nursing at Texas Christian University's Harris School of Nursing and an authority on NSRED. Lee, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
All right, Lee, what is NSRED?
Well, NSRED stands for Nocturnal Sleep-Related Eating Disorder. That's a very long name for an occurrence in which people sleepwalk and sleep eat.
And they have no knowledge that they're doing this?
Most of them have no knowledge. At times, they have some memory of what they've done, but it's not very clear, and they are unable to not eat.
So this is completely compulsive behavior?
It is very compulsive behavior. From all the research that I've read, I would think something probably activates the hypothalamus, which is the satiety center of the brain.
So where you feel satiation.
Right, and it is not pretty eating. It's messy, it's primitive, it's just horrendously putting food in your mouth without any thought as to what it is or the food content.
Are there certain foods these people are drawn to?
They tend to go for the high-fat, high-carbohydrate foods.
That's not a surprise when you think about it.
Well, it's not. And what it is most of these people are trying to eat healthy and live a healthy lifestyle during the daytime, but when they go to sleep, what they eat does not mimic their daytime choices.
Are these people who generally have problems with weight issues?
I don't know if that's the case across the board. I do know that if you continually sleep eat night after night and you're ingesting an extra 500 to 2,000 calories a night, you will gain weight.
It sounds like it's a guarantee.
It's pretty much a guarantee. And then what the people try to do is compensate by exercising and cutting down their diet in the daytime, which it starts a vicious cycle.
Yeah. Is there a certain personality type, or is this something that is really about chemistry in the body?
I'm thinking it's about chemistry in the body. We don't have any research to validate a personality type, and we have very little research on the possible causes. The people don't usually have a primary psychiatric disorder. But what happens from the sleep eating and the whole series of trying to get help, being ridiculed, being ashamed of what they're doing and unable to stop, they tend to develop depression and anxiety.
Yeah.
So that's a secondary issue related to sleep eating.
Is there any treatment?
There is treatment that seems to be helpful. We've got non-pharmacological methods, which I'm all for, and we've got some pharmacological methods that have been helpful for some patients. Non-pharmacological issues that have been helpful would be to eat a balanced diet through the day. You know, don't skimp and don't cut back on any one type of food. Just try to eat a balanced diet during the day.
Mm-hmm.
Exercise, stress management. There's a term called sleep hygiene, so you'd want to promote good sleep hygiene. And you do that by going to bed about the same time every night, getting up about the same time every day. If you need to engage in a little ritual before you go to bed, such as reading a book for an hour to help calm you down, do that. Things of that nature.
Mm-hmm.
Some people, that's not enough, though, and they have to turn to pharmacological interventions. And one thing you have to do is assess to see if they have any other processes going on, such as restless leg syndrome, periodic limb movement, or obstructive sleep apnea.
Mm-hmm.
And if any of those processes are going on, then if you treat those, then hopefully the sleep eating episodes will greatly be decreased, or maybe they will stop altogether.
Uh-huh. So it sounds like something that has ongoing research.
It does. We've really just started doing research on this topic in the 1990s. But it's getting more visibility with the medical community, the nursing community, and the lay people. So I think we'll hear more about this in the future.
Well, Lee Montgomery, thank you.
Well, I want to thank you, too. This has been great, and I appreciate your interest.
Registered nurse Lee Montgomery is an authority on nocturnal sleep-related eating disorder. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. And remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. And until next week, let me leave you with this observation from Miss Piggy about eating artichokes. She said, after all the trouble, you get as much actual food from an artichoke as you get from licking 30 or 40 postage stamps. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target. Everything you heard here and so much more can be found on our website, that's splendidtable.org. And be sure to check out the Splendid Table store while you're there. All the proceeds go to support this very program. And don't miss out on our free newsletter. It's called Weeknight Kitchen, and we hope it helps make your weeknight cooking a little easier. Register for it online at splendidtable.org. Our producer is Sally Swift with help from Jennifer Russell. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. The Splendid Table is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed nationwide by Public Radio International. Have a great week and join us next time. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
Public Radio International.